ask questions like this, you get divided answers, and what do you go with now? Is anybody cold? I know, Donna, but anybody, is this too cold for anyone? It's noisy, yeah. How about we just kill this one? What's making all the noise there? All right, Psalm 92, verses 1 through 11. A psalm, a song for the Sabbath day. It is good to confess to Yahweh and to carol to your name, Most High, to disclose your loving kindness in the morning and your faithfulness in the night. On a decachord and on a viol, on a contemplation with a harp. Because you have made me rejoice, Yahweh, in your preparation, in the occupation of your hands, I intensely cheer. How great were your occupations, Yahweh! Your conceptions have been very deep. A spiritually stupid man doesn't know, and a dullard doesn't understand this. In wicked ones breaking out like vegetation, and all preparing iniquity having blossomed, it is for them to be extirpated forever and ever. But you are in the heights to everlasting, Yahweh. Because behold, your enemies, Yahweh, because behold, your enemies will perish. All preparing iniquity will disassociate themselves from each other. But you will cause my horn to be raised high as our rocks. I have been mixed in verdant oil, and my eye will look at my foes in their rising up upon me. My ears will hear those doing evil. All right, our psalm is called a psalm in its inscription, and it is a song for the Sabbath day. Once we get this translated, maybe we'll use this for our Friday evening studies, in that it's made for Friday evenings. And maybe we can have someone of our number put some or much of this to music, and we'll use it that way, the way it was designed to be used. But our first verse is, it is good to confess to Yahweh and to carol to your name, Most High. Maybe you remember, if you have some years under your belt, as a believer, that is, you remember a song that came from this first verse. It's usually, the song is like, it is a good thing to give thanks to the Lord and to, I think it's praise your name, O Most High. In Hebrew we have a strange, probably to you, situation. There is not, maybe there is in modern Hebrew, but I don't deal with modern Hebrew, but in ancient Hebrew, there was really no word for to give thanks. There's just no word that really means that. Well, then why do we have it in our conventional translations? It is good to give thanks to the Lord here. I don't know why they translate it this way, but this is the word that means, and sometimes they do this with this word a good deal. They will translate it as to give thanks, but it is to confess. This is the Hebrew word that means to acknowledge sin to God, so you're not thanking God for sin. You are acknowledging it. This is the word that means to recognize verbally who your God is. So you're confessing Yahweh. And it's really not used like to thank or to give thanks. It is a good thing to give thanks to Yahweh, but it's a good thing to confess to Yahweh as well. And here it is that word that is used here. It is good to confess to Yahweh and to carol to your name, Most High. The A part of our verse is kind of objective. And then the second part of our verse is vocative. That is, it addresses someone. So there's a statement. It is good to confess to Yahweh. And then right in the middle of the sentence, you switch who you're talking to an audience, and then you switch to speaking to the Most High. Most High, obviously, highest being existent. So to carol to, got to be God, right? Carol to your name, Most High. That is to sing to your name, Most High. And it goes on to disclose your loving kindness in the morning and your faithfulness in the night. We're not saying that there's anything wrong with speaking about God's faithfulness in the morning or His loving kindness in the night, but His loving kindness starts another day. And you are banking on that loving kindness being with you all that day. At the end of the day, when He's gotten you through it, you can speak of His faithfulness in the night. To do that on a decachord. What is a decachord? What is deca? That's that prefix that speaks of 10. This is really just the Hebrew word for 10, so on 10, or on a 10, but we know that 10 is used so much adjectively with us. We're talking about an instrument. Elsewhere you find it, like in Psalm 33, it'll say a 10, and then there'll be the word instrument, or strings, after it. So you know what we're talking about there, but if we're just using that word as a 10-stringed instrument, that's called a decachord. And on a viol, then on a contemplation, so you're doing it with a certain kind of song. You know, when you find in your reading of the Psalms in your conventional translations and you see that this is to be sung on Higionoth. That's a transliteration of this word that we're translating as contemplation. It's a kind of song that is to cause you to think. And that's largely the kind of songs that we ought to sing if we're singing to the Lord. So many of our songs, if you do think about them, you have to say that they are not very doctrinal, or that they actually teach something that is not doctrinal. It's false doctrine. Oh, if they're popular, they probably haven't, you know, it's not so hideously terrible false doctrine, but our songs ought to teach, as Colossians 3 tells us that they should. I'll do a little bit of it, but I won't go on a diatribe here. But there are songs that say wrong things in them, but they're eaten up by Christianity, popular Christianity today. I actually heard someone, I thought, wow, somebody else does this. I heard somebody recently, just this past week, on the radio talking about this song, and the song that he was talking about was one that he said we sing it at Easter. We don't sing it at Easter, but many places Easter. You know that song "He Lives," and the end part of the chorus that you keep saying, you ask me how I know He lives. He lives within my heart. And this teacher was finding fault with that, and I agree with him, that that's not how I know He lives. Experience is never the condition for the establishment of our doctrine. For that matter, and he went on to say this, and I agree with him, that if you were to ask, you were to say that, say, to a Muslim, they would say, well, that's nice for you to have that as your experience, but I too have, what, a warming of the heart or an awe for Allah. Well, why is their experience not valid, but ours is? You might say, well, because ours is true. Yes, it would be true, but that is not the way that we establish our doctrine. I don't know that He lives. I don't know that the Lord Jesus Christ is risen from the dead because of any feeling that I have in my heart. I know that the Lord Jesus Christ is risen from the dead because we have the more sure word of prophecy, and then we have the word of its fulfillment in the New Testament. So my faith on the resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ is based on what is written. I just heard it today. I was listening to a very old, and it's not that old, but anytime you say you're listening to a tape, it's all real old now, right? So I was listening to this tape today, and it was, after the teaching was done, they were singing, and they were singing that song that is so, I always find fault with it with Matthew. Not that he plays it, he doesn't play it anymore, but Like a Rose, what's the name of that? Is that it? Is that the name of that thing? Yeah, it's not the name. But He thought of me above all. That's it, above all. Okay. No, I don't think the Lord Jesus Christ, I'll go the totally opposite direction. I don't think He was thinking about me at all. In His humanity, He didn't personally know me. And these are the days of His flesh. I understand I was elect. I understand that I was predestined before the foundation of the world. I also understand that when He became a man, He voluntarily switched off the free exercise of the attributes of deity, one of which was omniscience. And while He was thinking about the church, of which I am a part, I don't believe He was thinking about me. But let's say He was. Let's say He was thinking about you personally. He was thinking about me personally. He didn't think about me above all, more than the desire to obey His Father. He was motivated by thinking about me. No, he wasn't. He was not. More than the plan of God for all of time in this universe, He was thinking about me. More than that, no, He wasn't. I am loved by Him. I am cherished by Him. He delights in me. And all of it because of benevolence. None of it because of anything delightful or cherishing or lovable in me. But He does that, but that doesn't mean that I can go beyond that and say that song's really there on target. This happens all the time. I'll never exchange the old rugged cross for anything, including a crown. I'll never exchange that. As a matter of fact, I'll be more cross-centered when I get to heaven than I ever have been in my life. I'll never exchange that old rugged cross for anything. And I can't be confident that I have a crown right now. So confident to say that I will exchange the cross for a crown. Many of our most beloved lyrics are really very wrong. So, on a decacord, on a viol, or on drums, or on guitar, or on whatever we play it on now, our songs should be contemplations. That is, we should sing with the understanding, engaged. And the things that are sung should be engaging in that they lead us to truth that we maybe knew but didn't think of in that connection or think in that way before. Many times the songs that we sing here, that especially on the Lord's Day, I'm thinking in a freshness with them and getting edified by these things, by these words that we are saying here. So it's a contemplation, and then we haven't said anything about this, but with the harp. So we've got three kinds of instruments here: decacord, viol, and harp. The idea is, on instruments, let's play these things, songs that can be rightly identified as contemplations. That is, they communicate the true doctrine of the Lord, especially about His attributes, like loving kindness and faithfulness in verse 2. These things make up His name in verse 1. We do this in verse 4 because you have made me rejoice, Yahweh, in your preparation, in the occupation of your hands. I intensely cheer. God has made our psalmist, should be us as well, to rejoice in His preparation, that is, in what He has prepared. He's put thought to things that He is doing, and He does those things to prepare and to set up even other things in the occupation of His hands. That is, the things, not just things like we often see it contrasted, and I've pointed out this contrast to you in the Psalms studies before, between His extraordinary things, that is, His miracles. Do you know that the word extraordinary used to be a word that was used of miracles? It was a synonym for miracle. So His extraordinary things, that which is extra, that's beyond the ordinary. It doesn't happen regularly. But the occupation of His hands is over against that, because these are the things that He does all the time. It's the difference between miracle, divine miracle, and divine policy. His divine policies, we're rejoicing and intensely cheering about them, because the way that God always is toward us, the things that He always does, that we could begin to take for granted. And in one sense, we do take them for granted, not in a bad way. I take it for granted that, and you should too, we all do, most of us do, take it for granted that regardless of how significant of a failure I might be in things of life, we're saved. I was telling some people, Rachel was there, went through the, kind of talk about this with Leslie some time ago too. This woman, I drove up to McDonald's, and they know me. I mean, like, it's like they know, they see the car, and they say, "Do you just want a medium Coke with extra ice or anything else today?" And it's usually nothing else. And so I come up there, and there's this woman at the window, and I have my daughter's car right now. And it's higher and it's bigger, so I kind of have to lean over to give this woman the money. And she says, now I'm closer to her, and she knows me. And she you know, you exchange the pleasantries at the window, the little sundries, because she knows me. And she says, "How are you?" And I'm too close to her, and she's looking right at me, asking me how I am. I usually don't answer that question. And so I hesitate for what seems to her like an eternity, probably. And then I said, "I'm saved." And she couldn't look at me after that. It was like she just looked down, and act like she kept counting the money. She's not ever like that, but I'm saved. That's an honest answer, and she couldn't handle that one. And I've not seen her yet. She wasn't at the window today, but I wonder what I think she'll be over it by the next time. It'll just be business as usual the next time. I take it for granted that I'm saved. I know it's a forever thing. I know it's a done deal. Now, here's the other thing, though, that we take for granted. I take it for granted like it's old hat. You're carnally familiar with it. It loses its awe. That's not what I mean. But I mean, I take it for granted. I know that it's a given. That I will be forgiven every time that I sin. I know that God's love is invincible toward His saints. It's mine. Forever. No matter what. I know that His loving kindness is, what's that other word like, invincible, in something with a P, impregnable. Nothing can come against it. I know that His devotion is immutable. It can't change toward me. So while I do things that may not properly reflect the gratitude that one should have in light of His devotion, in other words, that doesn't fit with you knowing that He's totally devoted to you. It will not change it. It won't change. Because, watch this. 1 John 4:16. God is agape. Okay? God is agape. Malachi says that you, Yahweh, do not change. Therefore, we are not consumed. And Hebrews 13, honing that to just God the Son, says, Jesus Christ, the same, yesterday, today, and into the ages. So, Jesus Christ is God. God is agape. He doesn't change. Therefore, 1 Corinthians 13, 8b. Agape never falls. Just one letter difference, fails and falls, but it's falls. Agape never falls. Because God is agape, and God doesn't change. He is this thing to us, and He never changes. Therefore, He'll always be devoted to me. He'll forever love me. He will everlastingly be dedicated to my well-being. And there's nothing I can do to change it. And who would want to do anything to change it? Nobody wants to change it. I don't want to change it. I love it that it's that way. It's fantastic that it's that way. Those things, those kinds of things are His occupations. It's not a miracle. It's the way He always is. And actually, this is better than miracle. This is so far better than miracle. This is the way He always is. It's right to intensely cheer over that, over His occupation, the way He always is toward us. Verse 5, how great were your occupations? Now were, this is a past tense. So now he's thinking about things where God's policy was to act in this way. How great were your occupations, Yahweh? Your conceptions have been very deep. Things that God conceives of, His conceptions. These things, how many times, if you think about it, most of the time when we hear teaching in our church service times, like this one, I don't think I've told you anything so far that you've never heard before, right? I mean, we've never treated in all the time that I have been here as an elder in this assembly, I've never treated Psalm 92 verses 1 through 11 before. So we're, in one sense, we're hearing new teaching. Yes, we've never covered that one before. We're doing it today. But when you get into it, there's nothing really that we haven't heard before. Oh, you might not know what a decachord is, but that's not. I mean, that's just the name of an instrument. You've heard before about praising God on instruments, though. It's not something that you haven't heard yet. We hear about His loving kindness all the time. We hear about His love being immutable, unchangeable. That's a theme with us. You hear this kind of stuff all the time. But when you hear these things sometimes, you hear them in fresh connections that you didn't think of it like that before. Or you hear it connected with something else that you would have received you would have received A and you would have received B, but you never connected A and B before. And it's a fantastic correlation. Like maybe what I just did. You know that God doesn't change. You know that love never falls or fails. You know that God is agape. But maybe you didn't put it together like that, in that progression before. His conceptions are very deep, in that they lend themselves to that kind of use, where you always learn new things or new applications or new uses or new insights about things that you largely knew before. That's how deep they are. And then we do learn new things that we didn't know before. That's how His conceptions have been very deep. Then there are those things, there are those conceptions that are so deep that they aren't heard all the time. They're next to never heard, maybe you've never heard them before. I know that there's somebody who's telling me about how people are excited about our teaching Revelation, and been just holding you, just wait. Have to study this more. Too much I don't understand. Just wait. And now we're talking about after the Diet of Sauron, maybe not immediately after, but soon after, starting to teach on Revelation. That tent is fantastic. I love that tent. This is the third year where I've intensely studied Revelation all night long for a number of nights. I love that tent. But when we teach Revelation, then there will be things of God's conceptions there that are very deep, and I'm kind of excited about it too, because I'm excited about you every Sunday, not hearing things that you've already known. But you will learn. You'll learn. That would be interesting to talk about in some informal time, maybe after this. How you'll learn. I want to get into it now, but I'm not going to do that. His conceptions have been very deep. His conceptions are deep. They sometimes do not lend themselves, like Revelation, to just read it and you got it. Just read this a few scores of times and maybe you start to get it, because it's deep. His conceptions have been very deep. Verse 6, a spiritually stupid man doesn't know, and a dullard doesn't understand this. They think that you pick up the Bible, you read it, and then you know what that means. You know what that says, right? I mean, how easy is that? You pick up the Revelation and you read it, and it says that there's going to be locusts coming out of the abyss, and these locusts have teeth like lions and hair like women, which means they have long hair, and they have faces like men, and they got breastplate looking like things on, and tails with scorpion stingers on the end of it. They come out of that abyss, and so, you know, in the future there's going to be these locusts that look like this, and they're going to sting people for 42 months. Or 5 months, rather. 5 months. No. Not literally. It's not easy. I'm gonna tell you, there are not going to be, in the future, locusts coming out of a hole in the ground that look like that and sting people for 5 months. That's not what it means. This is this book full of symbols. It's all symbol. The vast majority of it is symbol. And the skill is involved in deciphering the symbol. In the future, there's going to be that. Why do you even assume that it's future? Why is it future? Why are you so sure that Revelation takes place in the future? Why? Because pop Christianity tells us that? I grant you a good portion of it is future, but the majority of it is past. Okay, that's enough. That'll maybe whet your appetite for such things, but his conceptions have been very deep. His conceptions, the way God thinks, they don't just jump out at you at a first reading. And the spiritually stupid man, this is not my subjective slander of somebody. This is the Bible's estimation of someone who thinks like this. The spiritually stupid man doesn't know, and a dullard doesn't understand this. What's a dullard? Have you met? And I don't want you to kind of focus on it and always identify somebody as this. But have you met the believer that it just seems like they can't ever get it, that you can say something very clearly, and they'll say, I don't understand what you're saying. That's fine, especially if it's new information, but then you keep saying the same thing, even if they disagree. It's not even a matter of their disagreeing. I don't get it. I don't get what you're saying. And the problem is not on the communication side. It's like, or the person, more often the dullard thinks he gets it. I know what you mean. You mean, and then something that you've never heard before is what you supposedly mean. The kind of spiritual makeup that just is very slow to arrive at what the truth is. We've studied this person just all the time in those 11 and a half years that we were in Proverbs. We saw the dullard all the time. It was translated as the fool. Well, what is it that the spiritually stupid man and the dullard doesn't understand? They don't understand that God's contemplations have been very deep. That this sometimes is not the easiest thing to decipher. This isn't just like falling off a log to study the scripture. Hey, Peter admits that in all of Paul's writings, there are many things hard to understand in 2 Peter 3. So if an apostle is reading the writings of another apostle and saying, there are things in here that are hard to understand, and there are many things in here that are hard to understand, and it's like that in all of his writings. then Paul's writings aren't just, you know, read it, you got it. Have you ever heard someone say, well, I read the whole Bible. Like, I pocketed it. I mean, it's you know, it's under my belt now. I know it. I know the Bible. I've read the whole thing. You're not getting the nature of this writing. We have an infinite mind with conceptions very deep, speaking to people who are sometimes dull, sometimes spiritually stupid, and at best, simply human, and not infinite. So we have finite minds receiving this infinite communication. All right, in verse 7, in wicked ones breaking out like vegetation. You know, like when it's spring, and you see the first, I don't know what they are, but crocuses or tulips or whatever they are, they're busting out of the ground, or after there's been a planting and it's harvest time and you start seeing corn come up. It's when the wicked kind of busts out of that which had them contained like vegetation, and all preparing iniquity have blossomed. So people who are devising wickedness seem to be prospering or blossoming, as it is here. In that state, it is for them to be extirpated forever and ever. Extirpated is the one word, it's a synonym for destroyed. When you see that, man, it's just like the wicked are flourishing. And wickedness is in its heyday, and it seems like all of the stops are being pulled out, and some of the things that some of us who are older would have never thought would happen, or maybe we'd think they'd happen, but not so fast in the United States. The change that we see, it's like vegetation that wicked ones are breaking out, and those preparing in this iniquity blossoming. Okay, think of it like this with God. Get this divine perspective to it, that it is for them to be extirpated forever and ever. So on the earth they may have great success, but that's so limited, that's so temporal. It's so small, and it is for them to be extirpated forever and ever. But you, verse 8, are in the heights to everlasting Yahweh. They break out for a time. They're like those things, because I was at the tent, and it's close to the 4th of July. They're like those things that you light, those snake things, on the ground around the 4th of July. They go, and they spin, and there's all this activity for 20 seconds. That's the wicked. They're like those, light them up, those little things, those little, if they're the snakes, I don't know what them, I'm not up on my firework nomenclature, but you know what I'm talking about, right? Like that thing, it spins around and it's very bright for about 20 seconds. That's the wicked. But God isn't just spinning on the earth. God is in the heights, and He is in the heights to everlasting. He's not so transient. He's not temporal. He's eternal. Verse 9, because behold your enemies, Yahweh, because behold your enemies will perish. Anybody has a better idea of how to punctuate what I just wrote there? I didn't know how to punctuate that. I'm sorry. But if we read it like that, because behold your enemies, Yahweh, because behold your enemies will perish. All preparing iniquity will disassociate themselves from each other. All right. Now, take a lesson here in Hebrew. We just had our last Hebrew class today. All right. For this wound of it. So, if you're a Hebrew student, watch this. Will disassociate themselves from each other. Six words. One word in Hebrew. All right. The semi-agglutinizing language called Hebrew's got all of this built into it. All built into one word. That's why you look at the Hebrew text and you say, wow, that'll go fast. to translate that, it's just like one line over there. Well, that one line is about three or four in English. We have here a hispael of a word that means to part or to partition. One use of this hispael form of a Hebrew word is to do something reciprocally with each other. So if you're going to part from each other, and everyone's doing it toward the other, you had a band of people who were in a confederacy against Yahweh. Well, now Yahweh shows up. Now it's time for him to cause his enemies to perish. No one wants to be identified anymore with the co-criminals here. Like, I want to distance myself from them. So they disassociate themselves from each other. But you will cause my horn to be raised high as owl rocks. I have been mixed in verdant oil. You must remember that we are dealing with literature of the genre called poetry here. You will cause my horn to be raised high. The horn is some kind of strength or power. It is a preeminence in one sense. If there's a horn on an animal, it sticks out and up usually, so it's pronounced and it's high. The animal that we're dealing with is the owlrock. An owlrock is a now extinct animal. This is going to tell you why they translate this as unicorn in the KJV. I think the KJV is the only one that does that anymore, but not anymore. They did it 400 and more years ago. But 500, I guess, huh? 400. They saw that this word was translated into Greek in the Septuagint as the word for one and the word for horn. And that comes over into English as unicorn. So they kind of took their lead from the Septuagint, the ancient Greek translation here. But an owlrock was a one-horned, now extinct, animal. Again, we saw, was it last week, I translated dinosaurs. These creatures, that whole classification of extinct creature that we put under that heading dinosaur, they're in the Bible. The Tanin or the Tanim are all over the place in the Old Testament. Then the New Testament just refers to Satan as a dragon, and it's, they were talking about that kind of animal. But here is an owlrock. An owlrock is mammalian. And it had one pronounced horn, very large horn, on the front of its nose. It's not a unicorn, but it's kind of looking that way. The horn is not in the head, but on this nose. And when the Lord Jesus Christ died, the psalm that talks about his death, as far as not the theological import of it, like Isaiah 53, but the personal effects of it, Psalm 22, says that he was between the horns of the owlrocks. There, KJV is going to say unicorn again. It was that he was with these nails, as if he was spiked with horns onto this cross. He was impaled. Another way you might look at it is that the cross itself was like a horn, you know, like it looks like, as I've said in the communion time last week, it was as if he looked like he was one with the cross. He was affixed to that cross. We've seen this word there in Psalm 22. You will cause my horn to be raised high. That is, the idea is you will cause my power, or you'll cause my authority to be high, not like the wicked, that this is just for them to be extirpated. They're spinning on the ground like that firework for 20 seconds. That's not what you do with me, God. He said, you cause me my horn to be raised high, like the horns of those owl rocks. I have been mixed in verdant oil. Maybe the best way that we could capture the idea of oil in the Old Testament is by maybe combining a couple words and calling it a luxuriant contentment. It's not elation. It's not necessarily happiness. But when you have oil, you're very content, and you have this thing that is throughout the Old Testament symbolism used of a situation or a state that was prosperous. It's like when I have a lot of Coca-Cola in the refrigerator. It's like I'm set. I'm not worried about running out. Or when my wife does this all the time. When she goes, she's on a somewhat of a vacation right now. All right. Why is your wife going to vacation and you're not there? That's what she's taking a vacation from. She's taking a vacation from me. She's gone. Okay. So she's on this vacation. When she goes, people think, like my son and Jill, they'll always invite me over for dinner because they think this poor guy, he can't make anything, can't cook a thing, and he's just languishing over there. No, not at all. My wife stocks up all kinds of food for me, and I eat more when she's gone because I have no sense of pacing. But there's all of this that's in there in the freezer, and it's like, that's supposed to last me a week. In the next 2 days, I'm cleaning out that freezer of all these things. All right, that when you're me and you're full and you've enjoyed all of these foods that you like, because she's not buying me, you know, low taste foods. You can note those when you're in the supermarket. They're called like low fat or low light or something like that. That's code for low taste. Okay? So she doesn't buy any of those things because she knows I don't do this. She tries to get over on me one time. She got muffins that were light. And she took the light thing off of it because she wants me not to ingest so much fat. And she got real ones, and she got those and she switched them. And so she said, here, I bought you some of these blueberry muffins, and I ate this. She said, and she's like, sure, I'm not going to tell the difference. She said, how do you like those muffins? Those are very good. I said, no, there's something missing. There's like, this doesn't taste well. I don't want another one. And then I heard her talking. Was it to you, Shay? She was talking to someone. She said, I don't know how he knew. I took this off. It's like, they taste fine. All right. Oil is that it pictures that state where, hey, I've got everything I love, and I have had a lot of it, and I still do. Luxuriant contentment. God has soulically, spiritually, you know, not necessarily physically, he's given us a state where we enjoy this relationship with God. These things that we talked about as being givens. We have these things, it's like being mixed in verdant oil. Like, not just like I've got the oil, like you threw me into it. And it's all around me, it's verdant. It's green. The idea is usually gets translated fresh. And my eye will look at my foes in their rising up upon me. The idea is that I'll just look at it, I'll watch it, and not be afraid. Oh, they're rising up. And it doesn't affect me, as far as anxiety, doesn't affect me as far as depression, doesn't affect me as far as fear. I see it. Okay, that happens. My ears will hear those doing evil. I hear about that. And I'm not disturbed. I'm not rattled. I'm not rocked. I'm not shaken. Because I've got a stability that is God. I've got a security that He's with me. That what can you really do to me? Peter will put it like this. Who is it who will harm you if you prove zealous for that which is good? What will happen to me if I do this thing that's good? I know that people hate this. I know that they'll come again. Well, what are they going to do to you? If you prove zealous for that which is good, just live Godward and don't worry about outcomes. Don't think about consequences. Whatever happens, He's with you. He supports you. He takes care of you. He loves you. That's all I need to know. One having ears to hear, let him hear.